Today on Changing Course, our guest is Laurent Dubois, professor of history at Duke University, the author of multiple books. His newest book is called The Banjo, America's African Instrument, and he will be speaking today after an actual banjo performance at the Hodges Library's Lindsey Young Auditorium. That's today, Wednesday, September the 20th at 4 p.m. here on the campus of the University of Tennessee. Laurent Dubois, welcome very much, and thanks for writing a book on the banjo.
Well, thanks for having me in. It's great to be here.
What inspired you to take on this project? I mean, that's actually quite a large topic, really.
It's a quite huge topic, as I discovered. I actually started by playing the banjo. I'd played other instruments, and I took up the banjo almost 15 years ago or so when I lived in East Lansing, Michigan, where there's a great banjo and guitar store called Elderly Music, and also had, there were banjo workshops. And so I took up the instrument and then attended something called the Black Banjo Gathering, which was organized by C.C. Conway here in, not too far from here in Appalachia State University. And there I kind of discovered all of the Caribbean kind of parts of the story in the history of the banjo that had not really been explored fully. And as someone who'd previously studied the history of Haiti and other parts of the Caribbean, I thought maybe I could contribute something.
And that's something I definitely want to ask about, because the sort of quick history of the banjo is started somehow in Africa, and then it came to the south of the United States, and it sort of developed in what it is today. But that's not the full picture.
Yeah, sort of. It turns out that actually all of the earliest information we have of the banjo comes from the Caribbean. You can find descriptions of it in the Caribbean by the late 17th century. And the earliest one we have, I'll talk about this in the lecture today, in the United States is a couple mentions in the 1730s through the 1750s. So I actually kind of argue it's not necessarily the case that it wasn't in North America before that, but in some ways the pivotal story about how we get this instrument, a lot of it has to do with the Caribbean.
And where specifically, and what happened?
So in the Caribbean, again, this is probably not surprising if you know the kind of broader story, which is that slavery kind of launched and expanded in the Caribbean much earlier than in North America, and had many, many, many more imports. You know, 45% of the total imports of the slave trade came to the Caribbean. So you had a space where you had a very wide diversity of African groups on the plantation regions of places like Jamaica, Haiti, Martinique. And in all those places, you find emerging this instrument that gets the name the banjo. It has other names at other times too, but banjo starts to stick pretty early. And it's an instrument that I argue essentially allows a kind of crossing and encounter and dialogue between African traditions. That's like its first goal, actually, is to figure out how to bring together various African musical traditions so that musicians can play to a very diverse crowd, a very diverse audience that is on the plantation world there.
So if you go back to the continent of Africa, are there many different versions of early versions of this instrument, or how does that all play out?
So there are just hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of lutes and harps in Africa up to this day, actually. Very varied constructions, some plucked, some strummed. You know, there's lots of different versions. There's a museum in Belgium that has about 400 different kinds of these just from the Congo region. Some groups like the Hausa have dozens of different kinds of lutes, right? Then there are some, of course, that are more widespread. People might be familiar with something called the Ngoni, which is kind of played by griot, and that's throughout West Africa. What I argue is that there's something that's very common, though, across all these constructions, which is having a resonator, either out of wood or gourd, covered with an animal skin. So it's like a drum in a certain way. And that's something that people from all over the continent would have been familiar with, that kind of sound of the strings over skin. And so that, to me, that's when I try to define a banjo. I say that's like the core definition. You really have to have that those strings and the skin under the strings, and that's kind of what defines the sound of the instrument.
And then what was the next big evolution of the instruments, I should say, because they sort of evolved into this one type of instrument. How did that all happen? Where did that happen exactly, and how long did it take?
Mm-hmm. So that's the really interesting thing, right, is that so that diversity of instruments in Africa has continued. But in the Americas, you find a kind of homogenization. You get moved towards this one kind of construction. And by the 17th century and definitely over the 18th century, you find that you can find that same kind of construction in the Carolinas, in, you know, around New York State, in Jamaica, in Haiti, and Martinique. So interesting, right, that this sort of one version emerges. Part of it's probably because there's just contact and exchange, but there may also maybe people coming to the kind of same place. And what, again, I argue is what the musicians needed was an instrument that could play a lot of different kinds of songs while still being identifiably African, right? So the point of the instrument was that it was clearly African in a general sense, but also allowed them to play across these different traditions. So you get a kind of consolidation of that, that essentially is what the instrument is all the way up until the early 19th century. Instrument made in enslaved communities, made artisanally with gourds usually and a skin, different kinds of necks, made by basically the people who are also going to play them or others who they're working with, not created on an industrial scale until the 1830s and 1840s when that all changes.
How long did it stay within the slave culture?
We really don't have almost any indication of whites taking up the instrument up until the early 19th century, 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. So it seems to have mostly been within those cultures, and not only in slave cultures, because there's also free people of African descent right. who played it, and it's played in a lot of settings. And it's very visible to white observers. Thomas Jefferson writes about it. A lot of people notice it and write about it. And it actually turns into kind of a symbol in literature in the 18th century already. You know, when you write about slavery, you start writing about banjos very early, right? So there's a kind of symbolism around it that gets generated pretty quickly among white writers. The first people who really start playing it, one in particular that's celebrated or written about a lot, is Joel Walker Sweeney, who's from Appomattox, Virginia, learned to play from African-American players and then ended up going to New York and essentially helping to create the genre known as blackface minstrelsy, which was essentially white musicians in blackface presenting themselves as performing black music. Doing so mostly in northern urban areas at first, and then that became a major movement.
And, you know, when you mention banjos to people, you get all sorts of reactions, and you get some jokes on occasion.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's a lot of classic jokes. But when I talk to people about the banjo, they almost see it in very strict terms as almost basically a folk and bluegrass instrument in the Appalachians and have no idea of its actual history. Do you find this to be true as well?
Yeah, and that was part of what I wanted to sort of talk about in the book or address in the book. I mean, no doubt by the 19th century and into the 20th century, it gets really rooted in Appalachian culture, and there's incredible, you know, musicians who kind of use the instrument and develop all kinds of new styles and ways of playing it too. So there's absolutely no doubt that it's rooted very much in Appalachian culture, but it gets here from these other spaces, right? And those larger roots and those deeper roots, I think, need to be recognized. It's also true that the banjo, as I write about, was really crucial in early New Orleans jazz. You know, it continued to be played in, there was a kind of giant orchestra in early 20th century New York that had a whole banjo section, you know. So African-American musicians kept playing it in jazz. They kept playing it in rural areas. So we get, by the late 20th century, a rewriting or kind of erasing of the history of the banjo, basically partly because of the ways that sort of bluegrass music and folk get presented and marketed. And so there's a lot of that history that gets kind of erased. But as is the case with lots of other music, you know, all American music is a result of this kind of fusion. And the influence of African music is everywhere, as we acknowledge in rock and other forms. So the banjo is kind of a really key symbol there. It kind of makes that clear. And what I would say is that the thing about the big picture thing about the banjo is that it was created to cross boundaries, right? The original point was that you needed to cross boundaries maybe between a West African and a Central African musical cultures. So it's not surprising that once created to do that in that context, you know, it could do that in lots of other contexts. And it's always crossed boundaries, you know, since then.
Well, we know that the banjo has evolved as an instrument in a couple of different directions, the open back and the one with the resonator. Can you talk more about that?
So partly what happens is that in the 19th century, after minstrelsy gets very popular, a lot of people want to start playing the banjo. And so you get banjo makers. And a big, big shift is that they move away from using gourds as resonators to having this kind of wooden hoop, basically. And then the other major technological shift, which is very important, is that they start using drum technology to figure out better ways to hold the skin and to keep the skin tight on top of a wooden hoop. And that allows, among other things, allows the banjo to be played in a lot of different climates more easily, and also just preserves it more easily because gourd banjos are very fragile. And keeping that skin on a gourd was always a technical challenge. So basically, once you get that, you get the proliferation of lots of different styles of making the banjo. And by the late 19th century, there's like patents filed all the time, new techniques for kind of keeping the head, for tuning it, those sorts of things, different necks. And there's a beautiful profusion of just instruments that are also just beautiful to behold, you know, with pearl inlay and all kinds of other stuff. So by the 19th century, you have this, it's a kind of an object of art almost to make these different banjos. And that's what you'll see if you go into stores. You'll see everything from banjos that are called open back banjos that don't just sort of, you know, the back is open on when you're playing it, to ones that have a whole cover on the back that projects the sound forward, which is necessary if you're going to be playing in a band or an amplified band and those sorts of things. So those are very different, and they tend to line up with different styles. In other words, bluegrass banjo often is that that latter construction. People who play folk styles will often use something that just has an open back as a kind of sometimes a softer sound. What one thing I'd like to point out is that the metallic sound of the banjo, you know, most people think banjo, they think like bling, you know, that's actually not how the banjo sounded up until the 19th century when instrument makers today make instruments out of the gourds. What you hear is this very mellow, kind of deeper sound. And that's actually what minstrel banjos often sounded like, too. So that's sort of interesting, too. The instrument has sounded in very different ways based on that technology change.
Pete Seeger gets a nice section in your book.
Mm-hmm.
How important is he, not just to the banjo, but to American music, and how does that all intertwine?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I found with Pete Seeger was important was the confluence of a lot of things that I try to write about in the book, which is the banjo as an instrument, but also as a symbol. What I kind of argue is that the banjo made Pete Seeger possible in a certain way, that, you know, by picking up the banjo, he was able to tap into deep wells of symbolism, and that kind of rendered possible what he did as a musician, which was, among other things, to make the banjo popular in new ways, at least, or bring it to new audiences, or kind of bring it back out in a certain way. I mean, I tell the story of his various banjos, and, you know, like a lot of other people, Scruggs saw this too, that there was a time when the banjo was really not popular. You could walk into any pawn shop and buy a beautiful 19th century banjo, you know, for nothing. Later on, Pete Seeger's banjo was stolen out of his car because they've gotten, I guess, too popular. So he sort of changes just the place of the instrument in popular culture. But I wrote about him a lot, in part because he also then, of course, connects to some extent to the African-American history of the banjo, right? I mean, he's playing this in civil rights contexts. And so it's a way of bringing the story back around to the sort of its roots in some ways in the larger history. So, of course, he's the other thing that I guess people today don't, it's not as evident to people, but things like bluegrass and folk really were very intertwined in their emergence in the 50s and 60s. And it's Mike Seeger, Pete's, you know, half-brother, who is one of the first to sort of use the term bluegrass and to put out sort of collections of this music. So the emergence of those in the 50s and 60s was really intertwined. Sometimes now they're thought about as kind of like different, you know, demographics or different areas. But that music, too, was really deeply intertwined. And the folk musicians really admired the bluegrass players a lot.
While you were researching this book, I just have this vision in my head that it was just an immense project because, mm-hmm. I mean, it is such a big thing. How long did it take you to finish this project? And did you personally have any surprises that you discovered along the way?
There were a lot of surprises. I mean, the reason the book was a challenge took about a decade, although even that decade was rooted in earlier work I'd done that enabled me to look for these things, you know, because a big part of the book is something that we as historians of slavery often do, which is you have to piece things together from fragments. It's almost a kind of archaeology. You know, the traces of the culture of the enslaved there's not that many of them in writing. You know, there wasn't a huge interest, and it was often looked down upon by those who wrote about it. So you're looking for some visual traces, for material objects. There are very few, but there are some. So it was almost like putting together those fragments, finding the fragments, and then putting them together with a narrative was the challenge. When you get into the 19th and 20th century, you have a lot more material, obviously, in recording. But I guess one of the big surprises for me, partly I did not know actually all of the places that the banjo, actually the story of the banjo and jazz, I was not aware of and discovered, you know, thanks to these great people in New Orleans who helped me with my research and said, I walked into the Hogan Jazz Archives in New Orleans. The curator there just sort of said, like, here's a list of, you know, all the New Orleans banjo players that we have in our archives, you know, and so I discovered that. The other thing, though, was something about really early history of instruments that surprised me and is kind of part of the core of the story, which is that I realized that, you know, so the lute and the guitar and all these European-style instruments, all of those come up into Europe from North Africa and Africa during the you know, in the during the period of Andalusia, so the period of sort of Arab occupation or presence in Iberia. So that I didn't know, that like the European musical culture had been shaped by this culture and this exchange. But then at the same time that some of those constructions with the skin on it had existed a little bit in Spain, but then they kind of disappeared and became something that was mostly in Africa. So I ended up going really deep into very early history about sort of European and African music in order to understand the roots of what happened in the Americas. And that was all quite new to me as well.
I've always been kind of curious, you know, you mentioned the banjo in New Orleans, and mm-hmm. you know, it's on a lot of those early great Louis Armstrong recordings.
Mm-hmm.
What happened? Where did it go? Why did the banjo disappear from jazz?
Right. I mean, so one simple explanation is like the electric guitar. So in a lot of, and this happened in rural music too. Actually, so I point out the like reggae guitar styles very much are rooted in Caribbean banjo styles. For instance, there's a music called mento, and if you listen to mento and then you listen to reggae guitar, you realize, oh, that's the confluence. And part of it's just that if you're playing in a non-amplified space, like a riverboat, which is where a lot of the jazz was played, or outside on the banks of the Mississippi River, and you've got horns and you've got other instruments, a banjo actually carries pretty well in that setting. It cuts through in a certain way. When it's actually much better than guitar, actually, for you know that kind of band setting. So the banjo partly had a usefulness because of that. In fact, Johnny St. Cyr, who was one of the great New Orleans banjo players, played the guitar, and then his manager said, we need a louder instrument. So he basically took a banjo body and a guitar neck, and that's what he played, just so that the sound would project and cut through more. Once you get amplification and the electric guitar, that becomes less the case, and so the guitar comes in the jazz phase. It's really interesting with regards to blues, of course, because blues guitar kind of has roots in some of the guitar playing, and Gus Cannon, who was an early blues musician, played the banjo. But there's also a very specific – the banjo also has very short sustain. So depending on the kind of vocal styles that you want to sing with the instrument, you're going to need something a little different. So there's also, I think, an argument – I'm saying that because there's sometimes an idea that African Americans sort of rejected the banjo at some point because it had been associated with blackface minstrelsy. That seems basically untrue. Like people played, you know, the instrument, continued to play the instrument. I think the shift to the guitar and blues had more to do with just a desire for different kind of vocal styles and an instrument to go with them. So the instrument's always been part of African American culture pretty continuously. And, you know, we have a band called the Carolina Chocolate Drops in North Carolina that has kind of dipped back into that tradition. So that's another point in the book is just the, you know, I think that there's a lot of ways we obviously think about race and music in this country that tend to erase a lot of these histories. And the book is partly about just suggesting that these confluences have been much more complicated than we often think.
And I just saw just like a couple of days ago that Rihanna Giddens, who was with the Carolina Chocolate Drops, just mm-hmm. got the Steve Martin sort of award or the banjo award.
Yeah, yeah.
And bringing it back. Now, for me, I grew up in the 60s and 70s,
mm-hmm.
so there are three pivotal events for me. I'm going to see if these resonate with other folks that really got me excited about the banjo. The Beverly Hillbillies
mm-hmm.
and the movie Deliverance. It got me excited about banjos. It didn't get me excited about hiking. But, and Steve Martin,
mm-hmm.
the comedian.
Yep.
How important were those kind of cultural pop touchstones help develop the banjo mm-hmm. into a much more popular instrument?
They're all really important. I mean, the one that I most directly write about is Steve Martin, who I love as a musician and an incredible player. But also because he taps into, you know, the question, like, why does Steve Martin start playing the banjo is an interesting one, right? And he listens to various recordings. But it's also because there's an old performance style in the United States that involves comedy and banjo, right? That's not, you know. So he gets into that in the 50s and 60s and kind of takes it to a whole nother level. But it's interesting, you know, like that sort of Steve Martin and his banjo as part of his early comedic presence is really interesting. And again, that's part of a longer history. I think that in those cases, though, it's also true that there's this kind of it's interesting because all of those cases point out that on the one hand, you've got this image of the banjo as like a rural southern instrument. But of course, it's always actually part of pop culture, right? And has been a much bigger thing. Blackface minstrelsy was, you know, I mean, toured all over the country, but it was like highly urban phenomenon. I mean, it's basically invented in the Bowery in New York, right? That's where they invent this kind of presentation of Virginia music, right? So that's, I think, part of it is that there's always that confluence. One thing I do say about the banjo, I think there's this kind of magic to the banjo, which is that it's like can be transformed over and over and over again. But every time when it's played, people feel like they're tapping into a really old traditional instrument, right? So it's like, and I think there's something very American about it in that sense, right? It's sort of, you know, you can renew it and take it up again and again in different forms, but you feel like it's rooted in a certain way too, and it's connecting you back to earlier traditions.
As a historian, do you really hate the question, where is the banjo going next?
No, I love predicting the future. I'm one of those rare historians who loves to. So, you know, I talk about in the book, I think we're kind of, there's been boom and bust phases in the banjo. You know, people hate it and then they love it. And then, you know, during World War II, people melted down banjos to make armaments. And, you know,
this banjo kills fascists.
Yeah, exactly. Some were apparently made into tanks, you know. And so anyway, I think right now we're in a really great moment for the banjo. People like Rhiannon Giddens, Abigail Washburn. I mean, you can name so many amazing people who are playing, you know, in their own way. They're tapping into these traditions, but they're pushing them forward. And it's all over the place in a lot of different styles of music. You know, it's in Taylor Swift and Annie DeFranco and Old Crow Medicine Show. And right. Of course, there's many, many all over the country. People are playing, you know, in smaller gatherings. So I think it's, you know, it's a really iconic instrument. It's a symbol that is a very rich symbol. And I think, you know, like I described Pete Seeger, when people, you don't just pick up a banjo and it's just an instrument. You know, you're picking up a banjo and you're kind of connecting to a lot of different strands of American history. I think people sense that and are attracted to that for that reason. So, and you know, it just has a great sound. People are, you know, they kind of, people often stop in their tracks. I mean, some people start running, but a lot of people are, you know, first time you hear a banjo, you think, what's that? You know, and I think that'll keep happening. So,
yeah, that struck me as a kid. Well, I used to go for long time Knoxvillians, Buddy's Barbecue on Kingston Pike used to have bluegrass music. And it was just standing room only. But I remember going in there and just being struck on, you know, how incredible the sound was. And that I was captured for life at that moment.
And I mean, what I always say, that goes back to this question of the drum skin on there, you know, because the thing is, you don't just hear a banjo, you feel a banjo, like the way, you know, there's actually a vibration happening in the space when a banjo is being played. I mean, that's true of all instruments, but there's a particular version of that with the banjo, because that's that there's a drum playing in a certain way whenever, and there's a hum to it. That so I think that's kind of, that's a part of the secret to its power, when people wonder, well, what is, why does that sound different, you know, in a certain way, or kind of stand out. So Taj Mahal once played in North Carolina, and he jokingly sort of said, he pulled out his banjo and everyone applauded and cheered. And he was like, I love playing in North Carolina because I pull this out in Washington and everybody starts running, you know. But I do think actually more and more there are a lot of people who are, you know, eager to hear that sound.
Laurent Dubois, thanks so much for being our guest on Changing Course.
All right, thanks for having me.
You can catch Professor Dubois at the Hodges Library Lindsay Young Auditorium on Wednesday, September the 20th at 4 p.m. There will be a banjo performance featuring Bobby Fulcher and Buddy Ingram, and then some Q&A and some talk about banjos. Sounds like almost like they're going to have a hoedown. Professor Dubois' new book is called The Banjo, America's African Instrument. It is courtesy of the Harvard University Press. For Changing Course, which is a production of WUOT, I'm Todd Steed.